Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Jason Manning. He is an associate professor of sociology at West Virginia University, and he is the author of Suicide: The Social Causes of Self-Destruction, which we're going to talk about today. So, Dr. Manning, welcome to the show again. It's a pleasure
Thank
to
you,
have you.
Ricardo. Good to see you again.
Okay, great. Let's start perhaps with a basic question. So, from a sociological perspective, what is suicide?
Well, as with all things in sociology, there's varying definitions, but I go with the simplest and broadest. It's the self-application of lethal violence. By lethal, I mean, relatively life-threatening or damaging. So I would count under the topic of suicide also attempts that people survive, as well as fatalities.
Oh, okay, so even attempts at suicide where people survive would fall under the rubric of suicide?
I would say so, broadly speaking, as a family of behavior. Of course, it is worthwhile to make a distinction between degrees of lethality in suicide attempts, because clearly some suicide attempts fall more towards the spectrum of what some experts call parasuicide, meaning it's very unlikely to cause death. It has all the appearances of being more of a social signal than a serious attempt to end one's life. And at the other extreme, you have cases where somebody clearly made a serious attempt and just survived by a freak chance or random luck. And there are all kinds of gradations in between. And it's worth, drawing those distinctions, but my approach is usually just to look at it as a very broad family of related behaviors and leave that question of lethality as a follow-up question or a secondary question behind the larger question of why people inflict dangerous violence on themselves at all.
Yeah, I understand. So let me just read a quote from your book and then I will ask you to comment on it. So, suicide one can see occurs in different forms and varieties. It might be collective or individual, voluntary or coercive, public or private, assisted or resisted, certainly fatal or a risky gamble with death. It might also arise from a variety of causes or contexts, such as depression, terminal illness, political struggle, or religious fervor. One major context for suicide is conflict, and it is this context that will be the main focus of this book. So, let me ask you, do all of these forms and varieties fall under the rubric of sociology? I mean, are they relevant in a sociological context, and why did you decide to focus specifically on the issue of conflict?
I would say all of them are relevant in sociological context. And what I was trying to clarify in that passage was something that I think is often ignored in a lot of scholarly and public discussions of the behavior, which is it's treated as just this single homogeneous thing. While I do believe it's one broad category of related behaviors that can be studied as a whole, it's also worthwhile to think about it, what it looks like at the ground level, at the level of the individual case. And you do see all this variation in how suicide's carried out and why it's carried out. And that variation, I think, orients us to situational and relationship level factors, which are my main focus. And so, why I focus on conflict is largely because that's something I am familiar with studying. I trained under a sociologist who specialized in the study of conflict, so I already had some existing concepts and a theoretical perspective that was well suited to studying conflict. And realizing that many suicides arise out of conflict made this an important type for me to study and a type to which I could apply the tools I was familiar with. So, that's why I focused on it.
But in this case, conflict, we're talking about social conflict, conflict with other people.
Right, any sort of clash of right and wrong, any sort of situation where there's grievances involved, somebody has defined some behavior as immoral or unjust or undesirable in some way, that's conflict very broadly defined.
So, I mean, Is it true? I think it's true, but it's true that Emil Durkheim was the first sociologist to try to study systematically the social basis of suicide.
One of the first, I think actually another French sociologist, Gabriel Tarde, whose name I'm probably butchering because I don't pronounce French very well. I think he published before Durkheim, and in fact, Durkheim critiqued him a bit in his suicide book. But yeah, he was definitely one of the first and by far the most influential and thus widely considered a founder not just of sociology as a discipline, but also of the sociology of suicide as a topic or as a specialty. And you know, his book is still taught to graduate students in sociology today. I still teach parts of it in my classes. Some parts hold up, some parts not so much, but it definitely a very influential work in the field.
So, tell us then what parts of it still hold up, and perhaps you also present in your book.
Okay. Well, Durkheim, and one of the reasons his book is foundational in sociology, he noticed that different countries have regular differences in their suicide rates. So he was looking at statistics from across Europe, and he found, for example, the Irish rate was always lower than the French rate, which was always lower than the German rate, and so on and so forth. And he found this very curious, this seemingly personal, individual decision, this internal drama of the mind, happens to play out in about the same amount from year to year, with that amount differing predictably from country to country. And he found other regularities, like different categories of people have different kinds of suicide rates. So married people, he found, have lower rates than single people or widowed people. People with children, he found, have lower rates than the childless, and so on and so forth. And so he formulated some theory to try to explain these patterns. And his theory boils down to two main propositions. One is that suicide is a eucurvilinear function of social integration. Social integration means, well, you can quibble over what exactly it means in the original work, and people do, but the way most sociologists would parse it now is it means how much one is tied to society, the density and number of one's social contacts and relationships and involvements. And so at one extreme, you have people who are very isolated, very few involvements, few connections to institutions, few relationships. Their suicide risk is very high. At the other extreme, you have people who are completely enmeshed in a group to the point where their individuality is completely suppressed. He thought this tended to happen more in tribal and traditional settings that were highly intimate. Also, I've seen this applied to modern religious cults and similar sorts of intensive movements. And he thought suicide risk then rose as well. The first half of that relationship's been the one that's most well supported out of all his work. In the centuries since, again and again and again, we've found that social isolation increases the risk of suicide. Having more relationships and ties and involvements reduces the risk of suicide. And this goes to things like suicide victims tend, on average, to have fewer friends than like matched controls from their communities. And they tend to be, single. They tend to be childless. They tend to not be involved in any sort of religious congregation. Actual, content of the religion seems to matter less than being involved in some sort of organized group. And so on and so forth. There's many different indicators of this, but it's been well supported, that half of that eucurvilinear theory. So the theory that suicide increases with a lack of an integration has been well supported. The other idea in his book was that people need some sort of, he called it moral regulation. He used the word anomie, which I think roughly translates as normlessness, to describe the lack of regulation. Like, people have no norms, they have no sense of how to balance their desires and their means of satisfying them. They don't really know what they can expect realistically from their lives or how they're supposed to live. And so he thought that this anomie or normlessness increased during times of downward mobility, economic shock, depressions, and recessions. And sure enough, he had statistics that showing that suicide rates increased when there were economic downturns. But he had a more counterintuitive idea, which was that suicide rates also increased during boom times, economic booms. And he said it was for much the same reason, because just as being suddenly poor leaves you not knowing how to live the lifestyle you're accustomed to living or what's normal to you to live, being suddenly rich also throws one's balance out of whack, stimulates the passions to the point where people, begin thinking the sky's the limit and they become frustrated that in reality it's not. So he thought suicide rates would spike during that condition as well. It turns out that's not really true. We have a century of research showing that, yes, in fact, economic downturns do cause spikes in the suicide rate. Unemployment, job loss, being evicted all increase suicide risk quite drastically. But boom times, really not so much. We actually have a pretty good explanation of why he thought what he thought, which was there was an error in the data. He was relying heavily on statistics from Prussia, and they changed their record-keeping system right around the same time they had a economic boom. So the apparent rise in suicides was illusory. They were just counting them better.
Sure. So in the book, you focus on conflict, as you said, but are there any other sort of political, economic, or social factors you haven't mentioned when talking about Durkheim that are relevant in the context of suicide?
Can you specify a little?
I mean, for example, you mentioned the effects of economic fluctuations, but
Right.
are there other identified political, social, economic factors that also play a role in suicide rates that we know of?
Well, one pattern Durkheim claimed to have found, and I think some subsequent research has supported it, though I haven't studied this one as closely as I've studied others. He found that rates go down during wartime. And his explanation was appealing to that idea of integration being important. He thought wartime sort of drew the society together in partisanship, and the effect of that we're all on the same team mentality reduced the suicide rate. In terms of other sort of collective things that might affect the rate, we mentioned the state of the economy and whether there's widespread downward mobility. Another thing has been studied, and this was by that first French sociologist I mentioned, Tarde, was what's called social contagion, or sometimes people use the word the Werther effect, based on that old German novel about a protagonist to commit suicide at the end. And supposedly there were some people throughout Europe when that book was popular committing suicide in imitation of that character, which sparked the idea that people, being imitative creatures, if they see some high profile instance of suicide, say a famous novel character or a celebrity who does it, or just cases that are highly publicized in the news, that can lead to people who maybe were on the border of making that decision to opt for suicide. And this is something that is, I don't think, established as firmly as it could be, but there certainly are some good studies pointing in that direction. For example, you'll see there's been several studies of how suicide rates spike following a highly reported celebrity suicide. And you'll find that in the region where there's news coverage of that celebrity suicide, rates spike up above the previous trend line. There was a study in South Korea finding a particularly strong example of this when a famous actress killed herself. Rates in the country jumped. I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was substantial. So there's some evidence of that effect of social contagion and imitation being important for suicide rates.
And is it influenced by culture in any way? Are there any cultural aspects that we know of that might influence suicide?
Certainly. I said, following Durkheim's argument, that the content of religion often seems less important than just the community aspect in preventing suicide. But I'm not going to say the content of beliefs is irrelevant. I would imagine a belief that, this is a one-way ticket to hell has some impact, some non-zero impact, versus a belief that it's a fine and respectable thing to do, maybe even a way of preserving the family honor. And so you look at something like the traditional Japanese approach to suicide versus the approach in Western Europe. In one culture, it's a sin and a shame. In the other culture, it's viewed more on a scale from neutral to positive, depending on the context. And not surprisingly, there's some relation to the suicide rate. There's some correlation with the suicide rate. So I think beliefs about the morality of suicide or its likely effects on the person's survivors or on themselves after death, if they believe in such things, I believe it has some non-zero impact. I would also say that culture matters for shaping a lot of the very other variables that might lead to suicide, such as how closely people are tied or whether they experience upward or downward mobility. I believe culture also matters for shaping people's sensitivity to those variables. So we might find some of the same things sparking suicide everywhere on Earth, but you might find some cultures are much more sensitive to those things. So, like, shame might be a cause of suicide everywhere, but it seemed to be a much more powerful cause in, say, East Asia, where people, the culture is more emphasizing public face and reputation than in a more individualistic society where that's less strongly emphasized.
Right. So focusing now on conflict, I mean, how should we understand suicide in the context of conflict? I mean, what sort of conflicts are we talking about here?
Well, just to repeat myself, in this subfield, in this branch of sociology I'm in, we define conflict broadly to mean any interaction or any case where there's a grievance that's been provoked or expressed. And so this could be incredibly mild from, giving somebody a dirty look or rolling your eyes or whatever, to very severe things like including collective conflict and warfare. What I find in my work is that suicide arising from conflict tends to cluster in certain patterns. One pattern involves intimate relationships, so conflict between family members or spouses. Oftentimes, you'll see, let me just give you two main patterns within that cluster. You have patterns where, say, a wife is being abused by her husband, and she might turn to attempted suicide to as a sort of way of protesting this behavior or getting him to stop it, or even to completed suicide as a way of escaping the situation, but also maybe getting some posthumous vengeance. And there are some cultures on Earth where this is institutionalized. It's a recognized form of suicide. For example, and one thing I mentioned in the book is some societies in New Guinea. It's just a known part of the culture that if a woman kills herself in a certain fashion, it implicates her husband. He drove her to it, and therefore he is, in local eyes, a murderer and will be punished. And of course, the women know this, and they know that if they commit suicide in this stereotyped fashion, their husband will be punished as a murderer, which might just mean being made to pay compensation, but might also mean he's killed in a vengeance killing. So it's a way to mobilize one's friends and relatives to take action when maybe before they wouldn't have taken action. They would have viewed it as just a marital spat or just a husband exercising his rights. Oh, now it's a murder. So you get things like that. You also get, for example, in rural Afghanistan, many women burn themselves in protest of their treatment in the home. Another pattern one gets among intimates is, say, there's a breakup or divorce. And oftentimes it's the male who does this when there's a breakup or divorce. He kills himself, perhaps out of grief at the end of the relationship, but also maybe with some eye on inflicting guilt or other sanctions on his estranged lover. I've seen several cases, many cases really, of men who say, like, go to their ex-girlfriend's house, knock on the door, and then shoot themselves in front of her. Just one last FU as they leave the world. So that's like the intimate pattern, or two kinds of intimate pattern. You also have a more distant pattern, and the prototypical example here would be many people in the audience have probably seen the famous photo of the Buddhist monk in Vietnam burning himself in protest, or in more recent times, Tibetans burning themselves in protest, or the case of Mohamed Bouazizi, the Tunisian street vendor whose self-burning sparked the Arab Spring. So people will commit suicide in a public and dramatic way to express grievances against the state or a corporation or some other distant and powerful adversary, often on behalf of a larger movement. And so we've seen suicide become part of the repertoire of political protest in the modern world.
Does sociology have anything to say when it comes to how frequent it is that people commit suicide, not particularly for social reasons, but just out of intense pain, suffering, grief, or something like that? I mean, basically internal psychological reasons.
I don't think we have any good hard numbers on it, partly because the two categories can overlap. I imagine internal suffering predisposes one to use this reaction to external problems, yeah, and vice versa, social factors shape one's ways of dealing with internal suffering. I do believe you're correct to identify that as a sort of pure type. But there are certainly cases I've seen in my research where the person's life was apparently going just fine by all external indicators, and they could find no identifiable reason. They just were miserable all the time. A coroner I talked with and interviewed once said those were the saddest cases to him. He called them the chemical imbalance cases. He's like, yeah, there's no dysfunction in the family. There's no job loss. There's nothing that can be cured externally. It's just she wanted to be there for her kids, but she was just so too miserable to live. Mm-hmm. So certainly those, that sort of pure type happens. And certainly the other pure type where the person's fine internally but reacting only to external circumstance happens. Exactly how one draws the line between them when there's, you know, various mixtures, I'm not as certain. And hard statistics on how many cases fall towards one side or the other, I'm also less certain. One thing I've tried to do in my own research that I say in the book was I just tried to get a count in one city I studied, how many suicides I would say were in some way sparked by conflict, whether they were sort of dramatic, I'm trying to get vengeance on somebody cases, or just, you know, the relationship had some sort of breakdown and that seems to have pushed them over the edge. And I'd say about a third in the city I studied, maybe about a quarter, had that character, that there was some interpersonal problem broadly defined that was cited by people interviewed by the coroners or by the suicide person themselves in a note as a reason for the suicide. Others were things like just ill health, which is way more common than people might think. A lot of the public discourse on suicide focuses on, say, youth suicide. And there's, you know, arguably a reason for that. It could be especially tragic when a young person does it. You know, they have their whole life ahead of them. But that leads people to forget that suicide rates in most societies increase linearly with age. And one reason for that is ailments increase linearly with age, cancer and all kinds of handicaps and so forth increase. And that certainly leads to a lot of suicide amongst older people. So physical pain, mental pain, they definitely cause suicide and can do so to some degree independently of any sort of social dynamics, but also social dynamics can shape how people deal with those things. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I asked you that also because I was thinking perhaps because nowadays when people talk about suicide, they mention mental illness a lot and say that suicide is the result of mental illness, like, for example, major depression or something like that. So, and I was just wondering to what extent sociology would have anything to say about that, not only perhaps a saying on if suicide is really the result of some internal struggle or something like that, and if so, perhaps have any saying in terms of to what extent that internal struggle and mental illness would be the result of social factors.
Right. Yeah, and that's one thing I do try to emphasize in this book is it's not that the medical model is wrong, right? I don't want to discourage anybody who's depressed from getting their antidepressants. I know many people they've worked for, and therapy has worked for people too. But it's that it's limited, and I think in the modern world often over-applied to the exclusion of other things. And like I you I've seen statistics floating around the internet on like these advocacy websites and so forth. 95% of people who commit suicide have mental illness. Well, how did you know that? Do they all get treatment? No. And how are they diagnosed? What happens is they committed suicide, and you decided it must be because they have a mental illness. Sort of a circular logic. And you start getting problems with using that entirely as an explanation because, for one thing, there's kinds of variation it can't explain. It can explain why an individual, with their, biochemistry or thought patterns or whatever, is predisposed to the act, but not necessarily why they committed it this year and not the year before or next
Right.
year. Often that's in a response to more changing fluid circumstances. And it can explain things like cases where the individual isn't doing it following depression. They're doing it following some, like, anger. In a lot of cultures, depression is not the normal syndrome that precedes suicide. It's seen as an angry act, a hot-blooded act, an impulsive act. There's none of this sort of withdrawal and lethargy and persistent sadness that we associate with depression in the modern medical concept of it. There's also the problem of people, and this is like a general thing, right? What's the term? Conceptual inflation, concept creep. Every unpleasant thing becomes trauma, and every type of sadness becomes depression. Depression, in its narrower clinical definition, is a very unusual mental state of extreme, sadness and lack of energy that has no apparent external cause, nothing that would, normally lead to that sort of outcome. Versus being sad because your wife died, that's like a normal human reaction, or being upset because you lost a job or your side in the war was defeated. So I think there's a need to distinguish being depressed over an external event versus depression in that clinical sense. And that's often blurred in discussions of suicide that rely on the medical model. So I'm not dissing the medical model as something that's not true ever or not useful for treating certain classes of problem. I just think it's often over-applied and often leads us to, here again, gloss over all this variation in suicide. It's not just one homogenous pattern. It's sometimes a pattern, it's sometimes an act that's committed in anger or in public as a matter of protest or in a relationship as not so much a definite escape, but more a gamble with death, hoping to, change the relationship in some way. These things often get ignored.
Is there anything about our modern industrialized societies? I mean, in comparison to perhaps more traditional societies, I mean, some, for example, social factors that would predispose people toward higher rates of suicide.
Well, the classic one here again is the social integration argument. Compared to much of, human history, where we tended to live in smaller groups and bands and villages and so forth, the modern urban setting is for most people a much more atomized setting. And there's exceptions and pockets of intense solidarity and so forth. But, generally speaking, people in the industrial world move around and deal with strangers and have much less stable and close ties, than people in earlier phases of history. So one might expect that to predispose the modern world to higher rates of suicide. Now, it's not always the case. You can find in the ethnographic record, tribal and traditional and village societies with astoundingly high rates of suicide. And it's not clear if we can establish just a overall, level of suicide being higher or lower between traditional settings and modern settings. That's not clear to me at all. I think it varies a lot from culture to culture is why, partly. But there are factors in the modern world that theorists like Durkheim would point to as making suicide more of a problem as things grow more atomized. And that's one suggestion people have had for why, at least in modern America in the past 10 years, the rate has been going up.
That rate has been going up, but is it in particular countries, and what would be the causes then?
Well, it's always hard, and in my own work, I rarely get into the macro scale patterns, because you have, in my opinion, to really understand them, you have to trace them back down to the individual cases. And a lot of sociology ignores that. You analyze the rates and you try to infer what's going on in the individual cases from that. I think it's useful to actually read the individual cases and try to then generalize to what's going on with the macro level rates. But the factors people commonly point to are things like economic decline, which we know has a correlation with suicide, and we also have a pretty good idea how that works at the micro level. People get really upset when they're thrown out of work, when they lose social status of any kind, including wealth or the respect that comes from being an earner, things like that. That one we have a pretty clear handle on. And for a big segment of, I'm more familiar with America here, but maybe this is true throughout a lot of other modern countries. A big segment of the population never really got over the global recession of 2007 and 8. A lot of the working class in various places never fully recovered from that and never got back a lot of the stability. That's one prime suspect for rising rates. Also for related problems, like in the US, like rising rates of opiate overdose, which may fall in a gray area in some cases between suicide and accident. Another one, of course, is declining communities and the breakdown of intimacy and institutions. Social capital has been declining for some time. And you've probably heard of the book Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. You ever heard of that one?
I've heard of it, yeah.
It's a common one referred to in this argument, and for a good reason. He's tracing the decline of all these voluntary associations and bowling leagues and men's, fraternal organizations and PTA, parent-teacher associations, all these things that people used to do, and organized local groups that just don't happen as much anymore. So these sources of integration are going away. And so that's another prime suspect for rising rates. And a third one would be like family stability. Which I think the last I heard, like divorce rates have been level for some time, maybe even declining in the States. I can't speak for anywhere else. But a certain pattern of suicide increases when divorce increases, because that raises the risk of suicide greatly for those who did not want to get out of the relationship. Maybe for those who did, it lowers the risk. There's a pattern of suicide where an abused woman can't leave a relationship, and so her risk is increased. But generally speaking, divorced people have a much higher risk.
Yeah, but I mean, because these kinds of issues get politicized very quickly, do what we know about suicide allows in any way for us to make a case against the way we live in modern industrial societies or not?
I mean, you can make a case, sure. You can make a case based on all kinds of things, depending what your concerns and preferences are. And as for things getting politicized, yeah, that makes it hard to talk about anything these days. People dig in on one side or the other. But yeah, I know. I mean, that's been a critique of modernity since like the 19th century, at least. That. This alienating, even Marx, who thought it would eventually turn out into a utopian ideal down the road, talked about, capitalism mercilessly just tearing asunder the social fabric, and all that is solid melts into the air and things like that. A lot of the early social theorists noticed and were concerned with these trends that are still ongoing. So you could have a critique of modernity or specific aspects of modernity that includes suicide rates as one of the problems. But here again, it's not just the modern conditions that can lead to high suicide rates. You can also get some particular conditions, such as high levels of conflict among people who are stuck together, that also lead high suicide rates, despite there being strong social cohesion in a certain sense.
And since earlier you mentioned economic factors, does economic inequality play any role here?
Economic inequality at the macro level is not something I focus on, though I could see one concocting a sort of classic strain explanation of this, that people see a class above them and want to have that but can't have it, and that increases their likelihood. But I focus more on inequality at the level of the relationship. So in the conflict, you have the aggrieved party and the person or group they perceive as the offender. What's the level of inequality there? And it could be economic inequality, but also inequality in hierarchy or power, ability to use force. Often the kind of inequality you find in like a patriarchal marriage, the guy can beat up his wife, but she can't retaliate. Or other forms of inequality like organizations more powerful than individuals. Parents tend to have authority over children. And wherever you see that sort of stratification in a conflict, that's when suicide becomes more likely, and specifically more likely on the part of the subordinate party, the inferior party. It's a weapon of the weak, a weapon of upward social control, a way to protest or punish those who have some power or stature and are thus less vulnerable to other means of conflict management. Which is why we see it, used in protests against the state or against corporations, or by wives in patriarchal marriages, or by children in authoritative families. That's where inequality is relevant in my work.
By the way, those kinds of effects that people who commit suicide expect to have on others in different sorts of contexts, does suicide really do have those effects that people expect it to have or not?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And in some societies or cultures, it's more reliable than in others. So, for example, I mentioned, like in New Guinea, the sort of stereotyped way of committing suicide by an abused woman is a fairly predictable way to cause trouble for her husband. And I can find cases of in the literature, like of a man who was hacked to death with machetes by his dead wife's family in vengeance for her suicide. In other societies, you have the belief that suicide will inflict some sort of supernatural curse or pollution on another person, which there, the effect is it's like a placebo effect or something like that, I suppose, or a social equivalent. People fear it because they believe it, and so it has the impact as a threat or as at least a psychological sanction, maybe even a social sanction if people avoid that person because they think they're cursed. And sometimes people succeed in inflicting guilt on those left behind. And I always didn't want to throw in the caveat because I know people who've lost loved ones to suicide, and you might get upset thinking about this because it tends to result in guilt anyway. It's an unusual form of death in that it seems to inflict a lot of guilt on the victim's close relatives. What could I have done? Why didn't I notice? What could I have talked him out of it? That sort of thing. Most victims, of course, do not mean to inflict this. Some clearly do, and they go to great lengths to blame a person and try to maximize their suffering. Leave them notes saying, "You drove me to this. I hope you think of my face every time you see blood or whatever." So you get that. And in the American cases I've looked at, it's often less effective than they think. Partly because, I mean, it's hard for me to tell. I haven't actually interviewed the people who are the targets of these accusations. But some circumstantial evidence in the records indicates it's not super effective. Partly because a lot of the people who try this are not the nicest people to begin with, like abusive husbands and so forth. And their exes probably don't feel too much guilt for getting away from them. There was one case of a man who shot himself in front of his ex-girlfriend at her wedding rehearsal. She had, moved on and found a new relationship, and I think that's what triggered it, was this realization she's marrying someone else. It's really over. There's no chance of getting back with her. And so he shot himself at her wedding rehearsal and said, "I'm dying. It's your fault because you don't love me." And she says, "You put me through hell. I'm glad you're dying." So it's not necessarily an effective thing to do at the individual level. Would be my advice to anybody who's mean enough to consider inflicting guilt on someone. At the political level, like protest suicides, again, somewhat variable. The Buddhist monk Thich Quang Duc, who committed suicide in Vietnam in 1963 to protest the government's suppression of Buddhism, depending what accounts you read, that had some effect on US government policy. Like, apparently John F. Kennedy was reading the paper that morning and saw the photo of the burning monk and exclaimed, Jesus Christ or something like that. And the US government soured on that regime a little bit after that. Another case, and I don't think Mohamed Bouazizi necessarily had a political aim in mind, but he certainly had a political impact when he burned himself in Tunisia, sparking a chain of protests that brought down the government. On the other hand, a lot of the protests of Tibetans who want to be independent from China don't seem to have swayed China much, or much of the rest of the world to stand up to China. And there was a religious group in China, Falun Gong, and they actually seem to have been counterproductive because previously people thought, oh, why is the government suppressing this harmless organization? And when they started burning themselves in protest, I said, well, they're nuts. So that's why the government's suppressing them. It just soured the public on the organization. So it's variable.
Right. Is there any relationship between suicide and homicide?
That's a good question, and one that in the violence literature has been tackled quite a bit. There's one sort of branch of theory you might have heard of. It's called like the hydraulic or stream theory of violence. You ever heard of that?
I don't think so.
Maybe I'm not using the right terminology, but it's the idea that circumstances can produce a sort of general urge to violence, like just frustration and aggression are just generated as a force, and then external conditions shape what direction that force goes in. And so, in some cases, circumstances, force that stream of violence back towards the self. In other cases, the aggression is channeled towards other people. And so, there are theories that try to start from that assumption of, all right, things like losing a job or going through a breakup or whatever frustrate people and make them turn to violence. Now, what makes them turn to violence against themselves versus someone else? And so that's one way of trying to understand that. Another way that you could look at them being related is that in some cases they overlap. There's a pattern where someone kills another person, then immediately after kills themselves. It's called murder-suicide or homicide-suicide. And there's some debate about its nature at the sort of interaction level. Is it primarily a homicide where someone commits a murder, then feels guilty and commits suicide afterwards? Or is it primarily a suicide in which they decide, I'm taking you with me? I think the truth's closer to the second category usually, because the most common pattern is, men who've been jilted or left by a woman. And sometimes they'll explicitly threaten, if you leave me, I'll kill us both. And sometimes they follow through with that. They hunt her down and kill her then themselves. And it's clearly both acts were planned from the get-go and part of the same sort of complex of action. So I consider it a hybrid behavior in that sense.
Right. But I mean, whatever kind of suicide and whatever kind of motivation people have to commit suicide across societies, I mean, I think I'm not mistaken, but it's only a small percentage of people that do it, correct?
Right. Even in places where it's, relatively common, it's still a rare outcome for individuals, definitely. And if you look at like if you think of this as I do, as your unit of analysis is the conflict, and why do some conflicts lead to it and others don't? It's even less common because so many conflicts are completely, mundane and over and forgotten about, and one dirty look and it's done. So it's a very rare outcome. And this leads to a problem with any theory of it. It's hard to predict rare outcomes. You always wind up over-predicting them. Any theory of homicide or of suicide or of terrorist actions, you find the things that make it more likely far more than you find the actual behavior itself. So it seems like I don't know philosophically how to address that general problem, but any rare outcome you seem to over-predict.
But I mean, what do sociologists have to say about that? I mean, that kind of phenomenon, how do you comment on it?
What the phenomenon of suicide being rare?
I mean, yeah, no, the fact that what you just said, that perhaps the causes associated with suicide, I mean, go increase, for example, but it's still a rare phenomenon.
Well, like I said, I'm not sure there is a handle on that as a general phenomenon, because I haven't seen very many people talk about it. But it's just a matter of maybe it's I want to use this phrase, it's cliched, but you ever heard that phrase, the perfect storm? Like the idea that the variables have to line up just right. So you can have something that triples the risk of suicide, but if your baseline risk is like, near zero, tripling the risk still means very few people who experience that variable will commit suicide. So what other variables might have been involved? Maybe their brain chemistry had to be just so to be susceptible to that external risk. Maybe all these other factors in their life had to be just so to point them in that direction. Maybe a lot of biological, psychological, social things have to line up right for it to actually happen. Also, maybe other factors like, I mean, opportunity structures. Do they have a weapon available? A rescue, is there anyone around who might rescue them? And this doesn't wind up in the suicide statistic, now it winds up in the attempted statistics. That would be my instinct when looking for why these outcomes are so rare, relative to, risk factors. Even if the risk factors are very dramatic risk factors, the outcome is still going to be rare.
Right. So, is suicide rational? I mean, is that a question that sociology deals with?
Sociology probably less so than, political science, just because the rational choice approach is it's in sociology, but it's more of a minority in this field than in others like econ. But anything can be rational given the right goals, I think. Like if your goal is to escape suffering, a gun barrel in your mouth might be a very rational way of ending, physical pain or psychological pain or escaping from a situation. I know there's also some discussion of this as possibly rational in an evolutionary sense. A tendency to become depressed or suicidal might have been something that evolved as a costly signal for bargaining in social relationships. And so it may be, in the ancestral environment, people who got into this, depressed mood or were willing to do some sort of risky gamble with death, got some sort of benefit out of that kept that trait alive in us. So I've seen that approach to it. I've also seen in political science, looking at suicide, terrorism specifically. I think we talked about this in our last discussion as a rational strategy for fighting. So you're making a calculated choice to sacrifice the self to achieve some objective. And you could say the same thing for pure protest suicide. Maybe the person burning himself in protest is actually choosing a very effective means of advancing the movement. And the other members of the movement might also be rational in encouraging this to happen, which sometimes is the case. It's not a collective behavior as such, but it's something that happens often with the countenance of the group. Okay, well, he's a hero for doing that. Let's go let him do it.
Yeah. So, just one last topic. Does sociology, I mean, does sociology tell us about any way of preventing suicide?
I would say so. And as with anything in sociology, I mean, there's limits to the precision of our ideas and thus how effective they'll be. But when we look at some of these external things, these social interaction things or kinds of social mobility or whatever that affect suicide, you start having additional ideas for prevention beyond, getting people their antidepressants. For example, there was one Japanese prefecture that had a high suicide rate, and they surmised that it was partly because of economic stress. And they started giving what they called hope loans, or something like that, like financial assistance to people as a means of suicide prevention. And the idea was if people could get this financial assistance, they would not feel ruined or not feel like they were a burden on their families. And once they started giving this form of assistance, the suicide rate went down, which is at least circumstantial evidence that it worked as an intervention. And it could be that those sorts of social welfare policies work to temper the effects of downward mobility on suicide. Maybe not erase them, because there are other things you lose when you lose the ability to independently make a living, respect and prestige and stuff like that, but temper the effect. You could also look at things like helping people manage relationships. If conflict in relationships is a major problem, is finding some sort of intervention to resolve that conflict going to lower the suicide risk? And exactly what resolve means might differ depending on the nature of the case. If it's, you know, the pattern of the abused spouse killing herself because she can't escape her abuser, letting her get away, giving her a shelter or some other assistance is the help. If it's the case of a couple, you know, divorcing and one spouse killing themselves because they're now lonely, if it wasn't like an abusive relationship or something like that, can you make them, you know, resolve more amicably and stay together? That might help prevent suicide. So focusing on these factors gives us another tool, I think, in searching for ways to prevent suicide. It's not just about call the psychiatrist necessarily, though that can help, but it's also about managing things like the downward mobility people experience, or their ability to get away from abuse, or their ability to work out problems in a relationship in a more harmonious way, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that perhaps the best ways of putting this knowledge coming from sociology into practice would be to try to, for example, using political institutions to change the conditions people live in? Or do you think that people, by knowing these things directly, can perhaps work with their social relationships and other aspects of their lives to try to prevent suicide for themselves and other people?
Maybe both. Probably the effectiveness of either would vary depending on the specific intervention or problem, and also depending on what your institutions are like locally at this given time.
Right.
I don't want to get into politics here, but I have more confidence in some than others. And so, I think interventions can operate at different scales. And some things are probably more suited to state level control, others probably to local volunteer efforts. I was reading about one strategy of suicide prevention. It's called just befriending people. And the idea is that's literally it. You start hanging out with them and listening to them. It's like a therapist, but you're not a trained therapist. You're not assuming the role of a superior who has advice or whatever. You're just literally befriending a person to give them that social contact. That's something that's hard to mandate from the top down, but people concerned with helping others might try to do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And does it work?
I don't have any hard evidence on it right now. Theoretically, it should, but I'm a professor. What do I know about practical anything?
Okay, fair enough. So the book is, again, Suicide, the Social Causes of Self-Destruction. Where can people find your work on the internet?
I have a website. Address is sociologywv.com. It's the initials of my state, West Virginia. I'm also on Twitter of the same handle, sociologywv. My book is available on Amazon and various other booksellers.
Okay, great. So I will be leaving links to all of that in the description box of the interview. And Dr. Manning, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
All right, thank you.
Hi guys, thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please consider supporting the channel. It's thanks to people like you that it keeps running. So I will leave links in the description box for PayPal and Patreon. Any amount, even just $1 per month, would already be a great help. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share the interview, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchet Perga, Larson Laugrera, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimir, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arnaud Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Enrique Lenia, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Pinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Life, Roberto Inguenzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Thiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Ivan Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Oslin Bullet, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevski, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Elman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafinia, Kian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Vanagdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Gidi, Sardas France, Nirban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, and Sergio Quadriano. Thank you for all.